That makes me want to say, well, I'm sure about you now. Makes us want to say just, well, glory. Beginning in the 1900s, the most popular question that was asked was asked of infidels or by infidels, unbelievers, skeptics, and scoffers. They would ask the question, trying to pin Christians into a defensive mode because they believed they had a question that Bible-believing Christians could not answer. Even at the famous Scopes trial, that question could not be answered, which is incredible. The question that was asked in the 1900s is still asked today. It was one of the top three questions that we were even asked in Malawi, in Zambia, and in any parts in between. The question that was asked then, the question that's even asked now is, where did Cain get his wife from? Where did Cain get his wife from? Typically, any time that you've been asked that question, you've been asked by an agnostic, you've been asked by an atheist, you've been asked by an unbeliever. Unless an agnostic, a skeptic, an unbeliever asks somebody that you know and they ask me a question, I really don't know. Well, in this message, I'm going to answer that question for you. I'm going to say a lot more in this message than the answer to that question, but you may want, for reference points, go back. What passage did Pastor preach when he answered that question? Well, it's in the one, where did Cain get his wife from? That's why I gave it the title there. In Genesis chapter 4, verses 16 and 17, I want to begin showing you three major areas that we want to teach about today. First of all, I want to speak to you about the indifferences of Cain. Cain is a remarkable individual. And one of the things that we come to remark about today, even this day and age, is how could a man like that become so indifferent? What indifferences do we see about Cain? First of all, we can see some attitudes of indifference through the love that he declined. Through the love that he declined. Now in chapter 4, verse 7, we see the love of God and God who is love pleading with him for his soul. Pleading with him to do the right and the righteous thing. Look at verse 7. If you do well, will you not be accepted? We see God pleading with him with a heart of love, pleading and inviting him to approach me in the way, approach me in the truth, approach me in the life that I have showed you through your parents, and you will be accepted. I have some people within the sound of my voice today that God is approaching you. God is pleading with you. If you do well, you will be accepted. But have you become so indifferent to the love of God that you can even decline it? Because look at verse 16. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. How indifferent does a person have to get? How cold-hearted do they have to become before the love of God does no longer constrain you? The love of God no longer compels you, and you can actually come to the place that it makes no difference to you. There's no difference to you in heaven and hell that you could say no thank you to the love of God. There's some people within the sound of my voice today, that's where you sit today with that attitude of your heart. The love of God is being declined by you. But not only do we see the love that he declined showed his indifferences, but also the lies that he declared. The lies that he declared indicate an indifference in his heart. Look at the lies that he began to declare in verse 9. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And an indifferent Cain says, "I do not know." That's Cain lying to God. Now, I wonder how you're lying to God today. How do you lie to God? If you've got an indifferent heart, a cold heart, you begin by declining His love, and then you go on by declaring your own personal lies. But there's a third thing that I want to show you here, the lives that he destroyed. We see the indifference in Cain's life by the lives that he began systematically to destroy. Let's talk about five lives or five groupings of lives that he began systematically to destroy, all because He was so indifferent that heaven wasn't that big a deal to him. Hell wasn't that big a deal to him. Being in a right relationship with God wasn't that big a deal to him. Being in a wrong relationship with God wasn't that big a deal of him. And as soon as he began to do that, lies began to dominate his life, and then destruction began to follow his life. First of all, notice his brother. He destroyed his brother's life, literally, physically, and volitionally. Look at verse 8. Now Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. The indifference of a heart. When you turn the love of God down, when you begin to lie to try to cover your own choices, when you begin to do that, destruction begins to follow your life, and murder is not beyond you when you do that. I know there's some young people here today that you're indifferent to your parents' prayers. You're indifferent to your parents' pleas. You're indifferent to the things of God, and I just want you to know that certain destruction awaits you if you do not do the righteous thing. We see not only he destroyed his brother's life, but he destroyed his parents' life. That he destroyed the life of his parents all because of the indifference of his own heart. How did he do that? Well, can you imagine what it was like for Adam and Eve when Abel didn't come home that first evening? Can you imagine the kind of thoughts that might have gone through their mind? Can you imagine the kind of anxiety that might have flooded their soul? Can you imagine the kind of fears they began to develop? Where is Abel? Where is Abel? Where is our brother Abel? And if Cain would lie to God, it wouldn't be anything for him to lie to his parents. But can you imagine how it was when he discovered that very first grave? When they attended that very first funeral? When they participated in that very first graveside service as they had discovered what had happened to Abel. And then to think, now we're going to lose Cain as well. And in verse 16, Cain left and departed the presence of the Lord. So he began to systematically destroy his brother's life, his parents' life. But number three, the next step in that is his wife. He would ultimately destroy the life of his wife. Look at verse 17. And Cain knew his wife. Boy, don't you wish there was more told about that than there is? Don't you wish there was more than that? Where in the world did he get his wife from? He's going to destroy her life. I mean, anybody that's turned down the love of God for their life, anybody that would lie systematically to God and anybody else, would certainly destroy your life as well and not think anything about that as well. But where did he get his wife from? All it says is, and Cain knew his wife. Now that gives us a lot of things that are presupposed in that. He had a wife. He had a marriage one day. He had a ceremony someplace. He had an agreement take place one day. Where did that take place? When did it occur? Where did she come from? Does the Bible give us any insights into this? Well, I believe that it does. If you've been participating with us in our study in the book of Genesis, you may have already picked up on that. If you go back to chapter 3, verse 20, let me help you out a lot. Chapter 3, verse 20 is going to tell us where Cain got his wife from. Chapter 3, verse 20 says, and Adam called his wife's name what? Eve. He called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living except Cain's wife. Does it say that? It doesn't say that. She was the mother of all living. There's not anybody that was alive that didn't come through Eve. Now that takes you to the next question. It might disgust you. It might hurt you. You mean he married his sister? Yeah, he sure did. He married his sister. Look at chapter 5 and verse 4. What else the Bible gives us about this? In chapter 5 and verse 4, after Adam begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years. Look at the next phrase at the end of verse 4. Adam had sons and what? Daughters. Adam had sons and he had daughters. But he didn't have a son after Abel was born for 130 years. So he had 130 years of producing daughters. Look at how do you know that, preacher? Well, look at chapter 5, verse 3. And Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own likeness after his image and named him Seth. From the time that Abel was murdered, there was 130 years of time that had elapsed. He had sons and he had daughters, but he didn't have a son for 130 years, but he had many daughters. Now, Adam and Eve were living under the bliss and under the blessing of the commandment of God. I mean, disobedience and the punishment of disobedience is fresh upon their mind. God said you can do this, but you can't do this. And so we don't want to do what God said we couldn't do. But look at what all God said we could do. Now that their mind is where it ought to be, what God said you can do is you can be fruitful. You can be multiplied, so go at it. Now, they didn't have TV and ball games to occupy their time. So imagine how many children they might have had with 130 years of being fruitful and multiplying. Well, a lot of children come along by that time in just 130 years. Now, we're not going to ask for real-life testimonies here, but the oldest person here is not 130 years old. But they've got sons and they've got daughters, they've got grandsons, they've got granddaughters, great-grandsons, great-granddaughters, and there's a bunch of them, and you've had TV and encumbrances and work and all of that other to occupy you. But what we find here is people that like to work and study on these things have told us that if Adam and Eve, if half of their children live to adulthood, and half of their children that live to adulthood got married, and half of the children that lived to adulthood and got married had children, and half of the children that they had from the marriages they had lived, then there would have been, in Adam's 930 years, over 1 million of his descendants that he had had a chance to see. That's by conservative estimates. So when we ask the question, where did Cain get this wife that he would destroy her life? He got it from his sister. He said, that's disgusting to me. He married his sister. Well, Adam married a lot closer than that. He married his rib. Go figure. So we see the lives that he began to destroy. Can you imagine what it's like? Now he's destroyed his brother's life. He's destroyed his parents' life. And now he's taken unto himself a wife. But not only did he destroy their lives, he destroyed his children's lives. Verse 17 tells us about the children that he would have. And verses 18 through 23 tells us about the grandchildren that he would have. He would destroy their lives as well. Why? Because he is on a mission of destruction that he is seeking to flee from the presence of God. He is consigned to be a wanderer, a spiritual fugitive, and a spiritual vagabond, and he's going to go from place to place, with destruction in his path. We see the indifferences of Cain, the love that he declined, the lies that he declared, the lies that he destroyed. But secondly, let me show you this. Now let's look at the inauguration of cities. The inauguration of cities. We could say the beginning of cities, but that doesn't go with the I. The inauguration of cities. Where did cities come from? I'm glad that you want to know. Look at verse 17. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch, and he built a what? City. And he called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. So there's three things that I want to show you about the inauguration of cities. Where does city life come from? Where does culture and civilization come from? Like Atlanta, or like Detroit, or like Los Angeles. Where did cities come from? Well, they came from a Canaanite civilization. And what do we learn about this Canaanite civilization? Now, cities are not a bad thing. You'll discover that in just a moment. But I want to tell you where they came from so that you'll know when you see what's wrong with a city, what needs to take place for it to become a righteous thing about cities. First of all, let's discover the purpose of a city. Let's discover the purpose of a city. What do we know about this building a city? You see, Cain, he was on a mission. He was on a mission of seeking to flee from the presence of God. And so he left the presence of God, the designated place where God said, I will meet with you when you come to me on my terms and you come to me in the right way. But Cain said, I don't want that. And so verse 16 says, Cain went out from the designated place where God said, I would meet with you. And a spiritual fugitive and a spiritual vagabond he was. But when he left there, the last things he said to God was, I will be a murderer. I mean, I have been a murderer. Somebody's going to try to murder me. And so God put a mark on Cain. And he told him, wherever you go, I'm going to protect you. But he didn't believe God about worship. He didn't believe God about salvation. He certainly wouldn't believe God about his protection. And so when he built this city as a place of refuge from anyone fleeing the presence of God. That's what the word city means. The word city means to raise an alarm. It means a place of refuge. Originally, the very first city that was ever built was built from a man of fear, trying to surround himself with enough people that he could hide from, that he wouldn't have to face God, and he wouldn't have to face the consequences of his sin. And so the purpose of a city originally was to be a place of refuge from the presence of God. A place of safety from the will of God for your life. Oh, how many people have fled to the city because they're trying to flee from the presence of God? How many people make their places, their homes, their residences, their businesses, in a city so that they can flee from the command of God, from the influence of God. But that's the purpose of the city to begin with. But now let me show you the problem of the city. Let's describe the problem of the city. He called the name of the city Enoch. Enoch, after his son. Now, when we discover the problem of the city, it matches the purpose of the city. It was named after Enoch, and the name Enoch means devotion. It means devotion and or initiative. And so what we see is the very purpose of this very first city was it was a city that was devoted as a new way of beginning from fleeing the presence of God. The whole structure of this city and everything that would go into it was designed to be a city devoted from people who wanted to flee from the presence of God and the authority of God. That's why cities sometimes are often the most dangerous places to live. Because they have been set up not on godly values, not set up in a way in which God can be honored and glorified, but for every pagan thought and every pagan vice under the sun to be flourishing with. That's the problem of the city. It was set up as a city devoted to being free from the presence of God. Boy, you can see that effect upon our civilization today, can't you? We don't even like in the United States of America anymore, some people don't, that we can say one nation under God. We've got people trying to say that that's the best thing for our cities, it's the best thing for our civilization, not to offend certain people by declaring our heritage, by declaring that this nation was built distinct from any other nation. It was built on Judeo-Christian ethics and values. It was built by men seeking God and a place to serve Him free from tyranny here. But we want to rid ourselves of that. That's the Canaanite effect upon a city, upon a nation. We see the problem is built for described for us there. But let's show you that. Let's declare the promise of a city. We discovered the purpose of the city. We described the problem of the city. But now let's see what promise God would have us declare about cities. We're not against cities. We live in one. We live around one, and we're starting a church in one. We are thankful for the city life. I tell you, when you study the Word of God, you find out what God thought of the city. The place where He sent the apostle to the Gentiles was to the city. Every city ought to have a gospel preaching point in it. It ought to have a lighthouse where its light shines bright and tall for all who are trying to find their way home. Let me show you two promises about the city. First of all, it's the promise of the eternal city. When we think about cities, it can't help but remind us of the promise of the eternal city. Some people say, I don't like city life. Well, you better get used to it if you want to go to heaven. You going to a city. That's what Abraham, when God called him to walk by faith, he called him to look for a city. Not just any old city, but that city whose builder and whose maker is God. And John saw that city. He said, I saw the city coming down, New Jerusalem, out of the heavens. Beloved, I want to tell you, we're going to that new city and we're going to live there. And you say, I don't like a lot of people around me. Get used to it. We're going to be around a lot of people in heaven. You have some good neighbors in heaven, though. You have some mighty good neighbors in heaven there, so don't worry about those things. We could speak a long time about the promise of the eternal city, but let me show you the promise for the earthly city. The promise for the earthly city. When we see why the city was set up to begin with, and we see the problems in the city, I believe God's looking for a man, for a woman, for a church, for a denomination that would say, God, I want you to give us a promise for our cities. God, I want you to give us a promise for Tucker. God, I want you to give us a promise for Atlanta. God, I want you to give us a promise for Lilburn. God, I want you to give us a promise for Loganville, for Snellville. I want you to give us a promise for Lawrenceville. God, we believe that you ought to be exalted in the city. God, we believe that your name ought to be praised in the city. God, we believe that Jesus ought to be raised up in the city. God, we believe churches ought to be in the city. Is anybody looking for a promise from God for their city? I believe God's going to give Atlanta to Rehoboth Baptist Church. I believe God's going to give Atlanta to this church right here because we want a promise from God that Jesus Christ is going to be worshipped in the city. That's why we're starting a church in downtown Atlanta. That's why we have this church right here. This is to be a gospel preaching station. This is to be a lighthouse for the lost when they look and see that this despicable darkness around them, when they get tired of their sin, when they get tired of their sickness, when they find out that they have chased their rainbows to find that it is nothing but an empty dream, when they're tired of their wandering, when they're tired of their searching, there needs to be a place that's standing bright, that's standing tall, saying this is the way that leads home, and it's the way of the cross that leads you home. The church is a lighthouse for the lost and the weary and those who are off the beaten path. Well, we see the promise of the city. Let me show you number three, the influences upon civilization. That was a city that's purpose was built to rid itself from the presence of God. That was a city whose very problems began to arise in that it was trying to accomplish its purpose. What influences do you see that come upon civilizations? And what influences could we see on our civilization today that went all the way back to then? Well, there's only two kinds of influences. There's the positive and the negative. Let's start with the negative and conclude with the positive. I want you to notice with me the influence of the God-forsaking line of Cain. The influence of the God-forsaking line of Cain. Look at chapter 4, verse 18. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begot Mehujael. Now, I'd have had a whole lot easier time if Junior hadn't have been here Sunday night. And his reference to hard word here. And Mehujael begot Methushael. And Methushael begot Lamech. I want you to look at the naming of the sons there. You notice the ending of several of those sons' names would be E-L. You see, he wanted to flee from the authority of God. He wanted to flee from the will of God. But God hadn't totally gotten away from him yet, or the concept of God hadn't. He'd even name his children with biblical names. But let me show you what influences the God-forsaking line of Cain had upon civilization that still rests today. It started right here with this city, and it's still present today. First of all, they introduced to us religion. Religion came to us in this first city. But it was religion without regeneration. It was religion. They didn't mind being religious. Cain didn't mind being religious. He just didn't want to be redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. He didn't mind having references to God. He didn't mind giving token gestures unto the Lord. He just didn't want to live under God's authority. And so what you have today in our society is religion is okay as long as you don't insist upon regeneration as the requirement to be right with God. They'll let you talk about this denomination or that denomination. They'll let you talk about this concept of God or that concept of God. But if you mention the name of Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life, they say, "Now you've gone too far now." Why? Because it's the Canaanite civilization. Give us your religion. We'll tolerate your religion. But don't talk about the necessity for regeneration. It's the effects of the Canaanite civilization. They believe in religion. They gave it to us as a society. But it was a religion without regeneration. Number two, they gave us marriage, but marriage without the biblical meaning. They would believe in marriage, but marriage without the biblical meaning. Look at this in verse 19. Then Lamech took for himself, how many wives? Two wives. That's the introduction of polygamy to society. It's the departure from the biblical model and mandate for one man, one woman, for a lifetime. Amen. Lamech would take and say, "I don't care what God said in the garden. I don't care what pattern God set up. One's not enough for me. Two is. We can see it. I don't have time to develop it just in the names of his two wives. Ada," and it says in verse 8, "Ada and Zillah." Ada means old or beauty. And Zillah means dark or attractiveness. What he was saying is, as long as they make me attractive, as long as they're attractive, as long as they're beautiful, if one won't satisfy, two will be fine. And so they give us marriage, but they give us marriage without its biblical meaning. And once you step away from its biblical meaning, then it's marriage, which would be right in any man's sight. You mark it down. The tide has already turned. And the Pandora's box has already been opened to where the effects of the Canaanite civilization is. It's not just a question of, can a man have one wife or two wives? Now the question has become, can a man be married to a man and can a woman be married to a woman?
Right.
The state might one day sanction that, but the state didn't start marriage. God did. God said it was Adam and Eve in the garden. It wasn't Adam and Steve. And God said, "It's one man, one woman for a lifetime is my blessings and my rich rewards for you if you can walk in that." So we see they give us marriage, but marriage without its biblical meaning. Number three, they give us commerce, but without compassion. They give us commerce, but with no compassion. Verse 20, "And Ada bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock." Now that phrase, "have livestock," is an interesting one in the Hebrew construction. It doesn't just mean that he had cattle and livestock. He had it, but he had bunches of it. But it doesn't just mean that he had a lot of it. It's where we get our phrase, he had a corner of the market. He had cornered the market in commerce. "I've got mine, and if you want yours, you've got to come to me." And he had commerce, but he had it without compassion. Well, he had a couple of brothers. Man, this brother's trio. You got Jabal, you got Jubal, and you got Tubal, JJ and T. And out of that, you see what has taken place. Jabal gave us commerce. Jubal gives us music. Music came from him, or the instrumentation of music came from him. And the music wasn't bad because music was before him. Angels had music in heaven. And music is designed to glorify God. But you get a bunch of people to get a hold of that, and what they want is music to try to drown out the presence of God in somebody's mind. And that's where you get the kind of heathen stuff that goes on in the world today. The kind of stuff that doesn't glorify God, that glorifies man and self, and it actually promotes murder and violence. And I'll show it to you right here. The fourth thing is not only religion without regeneration, marriage without meaning, and commerce without compassion, but it would promote power without humility. Because old Lamech, he comes along with Jabal, Jubal, and Tubal, and what he does is he begins to say that I am my own man and nobody can hurt me. Look at verse 23. "And then Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. For I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 70-fold. Now that wasn't just a speech. That wasn't just a dialogue. That was the very first song and poem recorded by a Canaanite society. That was a song that would be sung during that time, and it was a song promoting murder. It was a song promoting violence, and it was one not honoring the Lord or His life. It was desecrating everything sacred and holy. It comes from the effects of the Canaanite civilization. Well, I've got to move on real quickly to concluding this. We see the God-forsaking line of Cain and the influence it had upon religion, marriage, commerce, and power. But number two, we see the influence of the God-fearing line of Seth. The influence of the God-fearing line of Seth. Now, all of this time has passed on. The effects of sin has deteriorated society. And the Canaanite civilization has began to prosper in its sin and began to glorify sin, murder, violence, hatred, polygamy, and everything that's not dear to the heart of God they began to embrace. But now let me show you what God does in response to that. It says in verse 25, "And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed." What we find, the influence of Seth, is that men, through his influence, began to desire God once again. Once the influence of Seth came on the scene, you have Lamech, you have Jubal, Tubal, and all of his brothers and cousins and nephews, and you have all of that Canaanite civilization prospering there. But what you begin to have now is you begin to have Seth, the godly line, and men begin to desire God once again. They've been wandering long enough. They've been empty long enough. They've been without God long enough. And they're beginning to conclude there must be something. There must be something more to life than music. There must be something more to life than commerce. There must be something more to life than power. There must be something more to life than this empty religion we have. There must be something more to life than this. And through the influence of the God-fearing line of Seth, you see men beginning to desire God all over again. But it doesn't stop there. He passes it on to the next generation, and look at what it says in verse 26. "And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then with Enosh, men began to call on the name of the Lord again." When we have men beginning to desire God, it's not long before men begin to find a way to dialogue with God. Then men begin to call upon the covenant name of God. Then men begin to recall the covenant promises of God. Then the desire they have for righteousness, the desire they have for holiness, and God begins to speak to them, and God begins to show them the way, and God begins to show them the truth, and then the society begins to influence, and then the society begins to change. And I want to tell you, the cities might be in the gutter, but God doesn't have to keep them there. God can use you. God can use me to bring them up out of the gutter when we call upon the name of the Lord again. It's time for an individual to call upon the name of the Lord today. It's time for the church to call upon the name of the Lord today. It's time for us to rise up and say, "Oh Lord, the cities don't belong to the devil. They don't belong to the world. They belong to You. And we claim those cities for You, Lord. And we're going to take the cross into the cities." Today there might be somebody that's like these people here. You're tired of religion without regeneration. You're tired of marriage without true biblical meaning. You're tired of commerce without any compassion. And you're tired of power without any true humility. Well, the way of the cross, it does lead home. The way of the cross would bring you into a right relationship with God, and all these other things can begin to be added to you. I wonder today who's ready to join this church out of obedience to the will of God. I wonder today who is ready to exchange your religion for regeneration. Who's ready today to give honor to the Lord? Who's ready today to claim a city for God? Who's ready today to claim their neighborhood for God? Who's ready today to claim the world for God? Would you bow your heads, please? Father, we thank You so much for the Book of Beginnings. We thank You for showing us how it all began in paradise. We thank You for even showing us how it even got down into the pits. We thank You for showing us where society went wrong. But we thank You for showing us how a society can get right. We thank You for the godly influence of the heritage of people like Seth and Enosh. And Lord, may You raise up a generation like that here today. Lord, may you begin today raising up a new generation that desires you more than they desire anything else. Lord, may you raise up a generation today that just wants to dialogue with you on your terms, wants to hear what you have to say, wants to do what you say do. Lord, I pray today for those who you've spoken to already to join this church. I pray that they'll come today. Lord, for the one whose life is so empty and so meaningless and so ritualistic, Lord, may you call them into a life-changing, life-transforming relationship with you by grace through faith. It's in Jesus Christ's name that we declare your presence here. Amen. Now, church, would you stand with me, please? We begin singing.